Craig an alcoholic? Rarely have we seen a person fail who was thoroughly followed our path. Thank you to the old timers. Who constantly remind us that it's spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. But who led the way for us. And thank you to the newcomers. God bless you. God bless you. It was so moving. I just remember, just like that, you know, 2 hours of sobriety. Scared, frightened, just didn't know what life had in store for me, if anything. And here, 25 years later, I'm in Sacramento. What the hell happened? It's something called a spring fling. I mean, get a life. Spring fling, my ding. And I bet you that dance Friday was something, wasn't it? Bunch of alkies bumping into each other. I was born and raised in Spokane, Washington. I don't know if my parents were alcoholic. It doesn't matter, really. My dad was a short dog puller. For those of you that aren't familiar with winos, a little short dog just fit in the vest pocket. And they were raised during Depression, Prohibition. So, you know, they were used to bathtub gin, but whatever. My sister was 10 years older than I was, and for the most part, my childhood was about like this. It was those beautiful summer afternoons in Spokane with baseball, tennis, that wonderful musk in the air, and coming home to a safe environment and being hugged, and being given maybe a cup of hot chocolate and a kiss on the cheek and a story before he went to bed. And then it would be the autumn when the leaves were falling and those trees were changing color up there in Spokane, and you had that autumn moon, that beautiful, big, full golden orb at night. And you'd be outside playing with the neighborhood kids, and it was safe and it was warm. And I'd come home and sit down, and we'd listen to the radio, Boston Blackie or Our Miss Brooks or The Lone Ranger or my favorite, Sky King. And there'd be a cup of hot chocolate waiting for you and a kiss and a story if you were still young enough before you went to bed. And the soothing sound of your mom and dad's voices in a very small house. And then it was winter, and you go ice skating on the ponds, play hockey, come home. If you could, you'd hitchhike, you'd ride your bike in the snow. You get home, and they'd rub you nice and warm with a towel and put you to bed and give you that cup of hot chocolate. And if you had a cold, they'd put hot packs on your chest and give you a kiss and a hug and put you to bed. And by the time I was 18, I could hardly wait to get the hell out of that place. God almighty. Just so much love a person can take, you know? You know, it was isolation. It was all about me. I was the center of the universe, and you didn't count, and you mattered a whole bunch. And that goes on today. I'm told that I have a disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. I've come to believe that over these years. The amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's provided me the chance to open up compassion in my heart that I never thought was there. It's given me the opportunity to look into your eyes, the eyes of a newcomer, and instantly want to give you what I've been given. If there was any way possible to share with you the joy and the miracle that has been Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. But the old-timers had it right. In my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the Alano Club in Palm Springs. I may have had 2 hours, I'm not sure. And they wheeled a guy out in a wheelchair who was the guru at the time of AA. And his name was Chuck C. And he was hooked up to an oxygen tank. And he had the apparatus, you know, in his nose. And I knew that very well, for my father was dying of emphysema when I was a kid. And I knew the sounds of that machine as it rattled in the back bedroom. Fighting for every breath. And this guy, who was the guru, and I had found a spot right down in front, and I was lying down. I couldn't stand up. And I was laying down on the floor. There was about 1,000 people there. And everybody just applauded, and this guy got out of his wheelchair, and he stood up, and he said the words that are the mantra of AA and have been my spiritual enlightenment ever since. Keep coming back. And that's what it's been. There's nothing else that goes on here. Get your ass in a seat, shut up, and listen. That's what I was told. If nothing else, what I heard when I got to AA was the truth for me. All of the ramifications of my philosophy came down to this primal scream inside of me that said, what am I going to do? God, please help me. Please. I tried everything. I'd done everything. When I was 13, I had my first drink. I threw up, and that was pretty much it for the rest of my life. Yeah. Just throwing up and drinking. That's pretty much it. Yeah. Had some good times. Yeah, just threw up, drank again. And Sacramento is a very welcome place for me because I spent a lot of time here. You know, I built a log cabin up there in Mount Shasta. And I moved there in 1972 to get away from it all. And actually thought maybe it helped me get off acid. But, you know, I wasn't really a big drinker and a drugger, you know, in the early days. I made it to the University of Arizona on an acting scholarship, and I found marijuana, $50 a key up from Nogales. I mean, but marijuana was not my drug of choice. It just made me paranoid. Just couldn't take it. You know, I settled for beer and throw up, you know, and that's... 1967, I moved to Los Angeles, California, Hollywood, and was going to make it big in the acting business or something, and couldn't find work, and went to work as a security guard at Wacken Hut. You could get that job in one day, and they gave you a gun and one bullet. Guess who the bullet was for? And I went to work at Lever Brothers as guarding Lever Brothers soap factory from communists. You never know when a commie wants to get clean, but I was there and graveyard shift with Heiner Thomas and my gun and my bullet and pretty confused guy living in a garage in Inglewood, California, Slauson and Crenshaw. And didn't have any money to drink and use, so I didn't participate. And it wasn't until about 1973 that, or 71, 72 in there, that I found alcohol and drugs again. And then it was hallucinogenics and just about every drug you could use, MDA, THC. MDA was an animal tranquilizer. It was a drug they gave to elephants to calm them down. I love that stuff, man. I just, man. Acid, you know, blue barrels, window pane, those were the days. Drive your car on acid, upside down, whoa. I was working as a comedy writer, and one of my partners, there were three of us, Barry Levinson, Rudy DeLuca, and myself, and Rudy and Sammy Shore opened up the Comedy Store in 73. That's when I really got loose. You know, I was doing acid but maybe 3-4 times a week, synthetic mescaline, and, just every hallucinogenic there was. And really, really getting screwed up and uptight. And eventually, I was married then, had two kids. And we decided to take the Volkswagen van and move up to Northern California, up to the environment of Mount Shasta. Actually, it's Redding, and then you take 299 East, and you go up there in the mountains. That's where I relocated. I'd never built anything before, but I had a book called How to Build Your Own Log Cabin. What the hell? So I did that, and then I chopped the trees down, had no running water and electricity. So I decided to haul up the trees that I had chopped down with a horse, but I didn't have a horse. So I went and got a horse from a gypsy horse thief. The horse was stolen, but I bought the horse and put traces on him to drag the logs up, and the horse had never drug anything in his life. And so that horse wasn't going to drag them logs up, so I just put them on the back of the Volkswagen van and just ripped off the bumper and, you know, what the hell, and started building this log cabin, and in about a year it was done. I built the chicken coop first because I wanted to see how that worked out. So I lived up there for like 6, 7, 8 years, and then logged, and I was an apprentice plumber and smoked dope because there was a lot of Vietnam vets coming back, and I found out for sure that dope wasn't my deal, and finally hitchhiked back into Los Angeles in 78 and started doing some documentaries because I was broke. My family was on food stamps and welfare. I'd had another child by then. I managed to get this job at a sleazy cable company selling this idea about traveling around the United States doing a documentary called America Still. And they bought it, and so I had some income. And one night, we had big, nice, huge offices in Sunset and Gower, and I thought I was, you know, God's gift to everything. And a guy walks in, and he stands in front of me, and he starts, lays out this stuff, and he starts. I said, "What's that?" He says, "You try some of this." He rolled up a dollar bill, and that's the last thing I remember. That pretty much did it for me. You know, Chatty Cathy just came right out. I mean, I was like, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. This is it. You know, this does it. This fixes me. This fixes me. And I chased that high from that time until I quit. It never got any better. It got worse. But it led to so many other things until in about 1983, I was in Bangkok, Thailand. And my now wife, my then girlfriend, came over to visit me, and I was doing a movie there. And she opened up the door, I opened up the door, and she said, "My God, Craig, what's happened to you?" And I says, "What do you mean?" She says, "You're gray." And I says, "Well, that's the color here in Bangkok, you know, I mean, it's a lack of the light. Look at the light, you know." She says, "No, you know, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'm really sick, you know." She said, "With what?" I said, "Life, you know, life. I mean, I had speed, I had my drugs, I had my kit, I had everything. Nothing was working. And I managed to make it back somehow. And a guy that I'd known in college said, "You know, I think you're a candidate for a group of guys that meet on Tuesday night." And I thought, "Oh, for crying. AA," he said, "AA, yeah, right." So I went. Plummer Park. And it just seemed to me it was a gathering of used car salesmen. It just, I mean, they were nice, you know, nice people. Everybody seemed sincere. What the hell, you know? But it wasn't for me. I mean, I had my drugs. I mean, my problem was Valium. My problem was speed. My problem was, what? What the hell was my problem? I was dying, literally dying. So I thought if I quit Valium, I'd be okay. So 3 days, I decided to come off Valium. Have you ever done that by yourself? Oh, they don't write too many books about that. That's some hard stuff to come off of. I'll tell you, with the spiders dropping and everything, I want to tell you, that's weird. Well, I got off of that, and then, you know, I'm hitting cocaine, and I'm doing some speed, some Captagon that I got in Bangkok, and I'm doing some Thai stick, and so the Valium edge was off, you know, but at least I was off of Valium. And then I was trying to drop things one at a time, you know, and it wasn't quite working. And I went and did a play in New York. But before I did that, just before I did that, I'd gone to another meeting, I'd gone to another meeting, I'd gone to another meeting, and about the fourth meeting, I'd gone to a fifth meeting, I started going with, you know, booze. And I would just park myself outside and listen and drink. And I went out to a place called Radford. And it was a beautiful little place. And I stood outside, and I was with a friend of mine who was in AA, and I had a bottle of wine with me, and I wasn't a wine drinker, but there I was, drinking wine. And there was a guy in there speaking, and his name was Clancy I. And I heard Clancy speaking, he was doing Jekyll and Hyde. And the laughter was so infectious. And I thought, you know something? If I could have that and be sober, I'd be okay. Because I didn't see any way that I could have a life. I certainly couldn't do what I did. Because my whole life had been spent on drugs and alcohol. So I decided to give it a shot, and I got sober for 65 days, and I went to New York to do this play. And then they fired the guy. It was two characters. They fired the other guy that I was working with. Was two and a half hour play. And when they fired him, I decided to go out and get drunk till they hired a new guy. So I started drinking again. They hired a new guy. In rehearsals, I was drinking. In performances, I was drinking. And one night, I had a blackout on stage. In the middle of the second act. And it was a three-act play. And I woke up at the end of the third act, and I was taking a bow, and people were standing, and I was covered in sweat. And I was... And I looked over at my partner, my other actor, and he was going... And I thought, well, see, that just goes to show you, you know? I found the secret. I improvised the whole damn thing. I said, forget their play. I must have done a great play. What the hell was it? Well, whatever it was, if I can remember how to do that, and all I got to do is know how to mix my drugs and my alcohol backstage, because after all, I'd only gone through 2/5 of Courvoisier. Geez, do I have to drink that much every time? Oh, well, probably. So, but in my heart of hearts, I knew, you know. I was done. And Doria, my wife now, got me backstage and she said, Craig, that's the most humiliating thing I've ever seen you do. Yeah. And the next morning was January 21st, 1984, and I was running down Columbus Avenue to the Fireside Group. And that's when I got sober. I gave it up. I had no choice. I was dying. I was dead, alone, frightened, scared. I sat there in that meeting, and I don't know, I just didn't see any hope, really. I thought I'd have to give up everything. I didn't care. You know, I remember, so when I got back to L.A., the first thing I did was go to the Wednesday night group, Pacific Palisades group with Clancy. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, was Clancy's first baby. And so I got to know him really well. And I used to drive to those meetings on my motorcycle, and I wore my leathers and my helmet. And I'd park at the synagogue there and where the meeting was on Wednesday nights, and I just wear my helmet into the meeting. And I close the visor. I don't know. I had a guy come up and tell me, or ask me, he says, you know, do you think you can stay sober and still act? And I said, well, I don't know. He says, well, I mean, what are you going to do? And I says, I got to stay sober. What else is there? I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea. You know, I have no idea at all. So I just committed to the program. I started taking commitments. I had a good sponsor. I started listening to him. Started doing what he told me to do. Go to meetings, get commitments, be a secretary, make coffee, sweep up, say hello, do all that stuff. I don't want to do that. Do it anyway. Who cares what you want to do? I do. No, you don't. I don't? No, you don't know what's good for you. I don't. No, look where you are. You're an AA, asshole. Oh. So what do you think this is, a club? You think we wanted to be here? None of us wanted to join anything. Who do you think you are? Starting to go over there and shake that hand. Go over there and shake that guy's hand. Who is that guy? I don't know. Well, go meet him. Jeez. I don't meet people. Yeah, you do. You go over there and meet him. Well, he knows who I am. No, he doesn't know who you are. Who cares who you are? Who the hell do you think you are? Well, I don't give me your credits. You know, I mean, just complete and utter humiliation, and it was so good for me because it was so true. I had no idea. Till I got here, I didn't hear the truth. But when I got here, I heard the truth. You told me who you were. You told me what to do. You told me how to act. You told me that if I took the steps, if I did what you told me to do, that my thinking would change and my actions would change. You didn't tell me any great philosophical, psychological ploy. You just said, keep coming back. Sit down and shut up. It'll get better or it'll get worse. And my sponsor used to say to me all the time, you're not an alcoholic. Yes, I am. No, you're not. Yeah, I am. Well, I'm a drug addict too, but I'm an alcoholic. No, you're not. How come I'm not? He says, because you don't look like one. He says, look at me. Do I look like an alcoholic? I says, yeah, you do. He says, well, look at you. You don't look like an alcoholic. You know why it's going to be hard for you, Craig? For me, it was a day at a time. For you, it's moment to moment. Because you think you look so good. Boy, he was so right. So right. I mean, I ticked off the seconds that first year. I mean, I was on my knees so often. God, please get me through this moment. Please, I want to drink and use so badly. Just give me, I'll get to this one, to that one, to that one. And then it was meeting time. Oh, man. And look at the miracles. Look at the miracles that have happened here. Look at this tonight. Look at this tonight. What I heard here was you. And it happened about maybe the fifth or sixth week of my sobriety. I'd been working, you know, trying to be a secretary of the big book study in Hollywood. And there was a deaf contingent there of people that didn't have a sign language guy, but they read lips. And one night, this gal that I'd been working with, and she was really extraordinary, and she started Actors for Deaf Theater, who was newly sober, as was I, said, could you go to a meeting with me because my sign guy didn't show up and I can read your lips? And all you have to do is, when the person is sharing their story, the leader is sharing their story, you just look at me and tell me, you know, repeat. So I did that. The guy that spoke had just gotten out of prison after 17 years. He'd killed somebody in a crosswalk, in a blackout. He didn't even remember it. And his story was so powerful and so unlike mine. But as I'm looking at her and sharing his story, I am telling my story through him. It was the most amazing, phenomenal thing I've ever experienced. And it taught me something, that if I was willing to listen, I could actually learn something. You know, I could get sober. It was, I can't tell you the experience of what it meant to me, but it kept me sober. It kept me sober another week. It kept me sober another 2 weeks. There was a liquor store not far from that meeting. I can remember watching people going from that meeting to that liquor store. I remember that, and I remember how much I wanted to do that and couldn't. I remember trying to get into a liquor store, and it wouldn't open. I couldn't open the door. You know, just give me some relief. I remember trying to do that in Palm Springs. It was horrible, but I know what that was like. But if I came to the meetings, if I kept coming back, and I sat down and listened, something happened. There was a transformational thing that happened. And for me, it just started working a little bit better each time. A little bit better each time. And I felt a little easier, and I felt a little more at ease with myself. Because the last person I want to be with is me. So I came to find out that at about 10 or 12 years of sobriety, my sponsor had been killed in a motorcycle accident. So I had to get a new sponsor, and my whole life was like invested in this person. And he had invested his life in me. And so I set about to do that, and I started going to some bigger meetings and some different meetings all around town, and I started encountering what this experience was like being sober and what it was like to be doing a job that I'd had been doing all those years for me, and now all of a sudden it was like I had to have a different goal in life for myself. And I wasn't sure what that was, because I no longer wanted to be top of the heap, king of the thing, and, you know, all of that. Or I didn't think I could handle that. And I was very, very confused about that. And I struggled with it. So what had happened in for me is that in doing my work here, the work that we're asked to do, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth step, finally getting to the eighth step, and I'd really worked through that and really, I'd emptied out my resentments and anger and my frustration, and a lot of that stuff had ceased to exist for me as motivational tools for existence. In other words, I had no more resentments at the time. I had kind of a clean slate, which was really like very dramatic for me as an actor, because I'd had nothing to call on. You know? And I remember being on the set, we're doing this very, very dramatic scene, and I couldn't get it up. You know, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't find it. I couldn't get to it. I didn't know where it was. I was at a loss. And the director came up and said, look, if we can't get it, we're going to have to cut it. And I says, oh, gosh, you know. He says, what's wrong with you? And I says, you mean what's right with me? And he says, no, what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know. So I went over in a corner, and I prayed. And I just said, God, you know, this is you. This isn't me. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm doing. I just know I'm sober. You said do this. I did it. I really don't have that stuff anymore. What do I do? He says, well, go back. I says, I'm really afraid to go back. You know? He says, go on back. So I started walking back, and I heard this voice in my head said, it's for me. Do it for me. I gave you a gift. Share it. Oh. It's not mine? No, not yours. Give it to you? Yeah, I want it. I gave it to you. Right. So I went and did it. And it was all I had. And it wasn't important that it was good. It wasn't important that everybody applauded. They didn't. That wasn't important. What was important was I'd found a new reason. So every day that I'm engaged and I'm working, I get to go to a set and I get to meet somebody who's in trouble, or I get to meet somebody that's having a problem, or I get to meet an alcoholic and I get to meet a drug addict. And then they may not know I'm sober, but I tell them. Yeah. How you doing? I'm great. Doing good. Yeah. Hey, had a great meeting the other day. What kind of meeting? Hey, hey. Hey, hey. Yeah, just hey, hey meeting. And that's it. And pretty soon, you know, it starts filtering around. You know, I don't have a problem there. I don't have a problem doing that. Oftentimes I'm embarrassed by it, but that's what I'm supposed to do, because more often than not, what I find is this tremendous gift, that it's not about the work, although sometimes it is. Somebody on television does a show, or somebody in a movie, or I'll hear back that somebody saw me doing something and they say, you know, I was in a hotel room, I was thinking about drinking, and I knew that you were sober and I didn't take a drink. I mean, come on. How about that? You know, what a gift is that? And that's not me. That's you guys. That's what goes on here. You know? I mean, I didn't have a job. I'm unemployable, for Pete's sake. There's nothing I can do besides what I do. If I tried to do anything else, I'm at a loss. I tried. I mean, hell, I almost shot myself when I was a security guard. Just to take away the pain. My sister died when she was 48. She died of a brain hemorrhage. My dad died when he was 65. My mom died when she was 66. So I took my youngest son, Noah, up to Spokane, and we were up there, and I said, you know, I'm going to go visit their grave. I've never been to their graves. So he says, okay. And he was like eight, my youngest. And so went and got flowers, and we dressed up, got in suits and everything, and went out. Got the flowers, found out where they were, found the grave site, and went out there and parked the car, a rental car, you know. Started walking over to where the graves were, and these rainbirds go on. And sprinklers going on. I got the flowers. I mean, what the heck is this about? There's no other sprinklers going on anywhere. Just right. Why can't F? Noah's going, Dad, we're getting wet. And I said, yeah, I know. We're getting wet. Jeez. I had to say something to my parents for Pete's sake. Noah, come on. He says, I know, but Dad, I won't. Shut up. The flowers are being. Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. How you doing? Fine. Sober. Sorry. Here. Jeez. Get in the car. And it's sopping wet, the car. So we left the windows open. Noah's laughing. He's going, boy, Dad, that was really stupid. I said, yeah, man. Golly, what the heck was that? He said, I don't know, but man, look at you. I waited for years to do that. I wanted to tell him. That night went to a meeting on Coeur d'Alene Lake. Sat by the campfire and told the story about going to my parents' graves. And like, my brother-in-law is there. And I 12-stepped him. He'd gotten sober, and he was pretty much an abusive alcoholic, and he had like 4 years at the time he got sober. I gave him his first big book. Oh man, it was fantastic. So we're driving back to his cabin, his lake cabin, in the boat, and he says, hey, he says, you want to know what that was about? I says, yeah, I mean, what do you, he says, well, don't you remember when we buried your dad? You were there. I said, I have no recollection of it all, Bob. None. He said, oh, come on. Jeez. We got there and the grave was open and everything, and the rainbirds had been on all night and filled it with water. I said, what? He says, yeah, we had to wait. We had to pump the water out of your dad's grave. I says, you know, Bob, my dad's into humor. I'm looking for a sign, and he's showing it to me. And I said, but the amazing thing is, I never would have heard that if I'd not been sober. And if you hadn't gotten sober, I would have never known that. And for just that split second, there was such a beautiful connection of Alcoholics Anonymous, that without you, I can't stay sober. And without me, you can't stay sober. Without each of us listening and sharing and hearing, we have nothing. And that's the beauty of this program. Thanks a lot for asking me to be here.